When we think of slavery in the United States, images of southern plantations most likely come to mind. But northern states, including New England, played a substantial role in the slave trade. Starting in the 1700s, more than half of the slaving voyages left the U.S. from ports in Rhode Island, including Providence, Bristol, and Newport. So many, in fact, that the state of Rhode Island was referred to as the Deep North for its heavy involvement in slavery. Rhode Island is beginning to confront that history with the creation of the Center for Reconciliation at the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island in Providence. Elon Cook is the program manager at the Center for Reconciliation, and she joins us on the phone from her office. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the Center for Reconciliation is just in the startup stage. So tell us what the mission is.
Well, the mission of our organization is to create spaces for conversations about race. So we do this primarily by educating the public, educating churches, educating our communities more about America's history and legacy of slavery, and then making strong and direct connections between that history and the way that we interact with each other today.
Yeah, and
we find...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, part of that is a teaching museum, right, that's going to explore this intersection of faith and the slave trade?
Yes. We're in the process of creating a museum at the Cathedral of St. John in Providence, Rhode Island. And so that will be explaining a lot of that history, showing original documents, images of original documents, and telling the local story, because this local story of Providence, of Rhode Island, had an enormous impact on the national and international slave trade.
I think a lot of people would be surprised. I imagine as you
start
to educate, they are surprised, right?
Oh, definitely. I was surprised.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So how did the center come about, and why did the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island become involved?
Well, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island was specifically, it's sort of a twofold issue. For one, we have this absolutely immaculate cathedral that was unable to support itself and was in need of a new purpose. But at the exact same time, the Diocese of Rhode Island was looking for ways to do something about racial problems in our community, in our country. This is also issues that the National Episcopal Church had been dealing with and was really, really wrestling with. And so they decided that they wanted to create an organization to directly deal with why it's so difficult for people to come together across race. And so that's really how the Center for Reconciliation began.
And also, there's a prominent Episcopalian family, the DeWolfs, who play into this as well.
Yes. And so the DeWolfs were the major slave trading dynasty in American history. And one of their descendants is on our board. Several of their family members have been involved in one way or another in promoting educating the public about this history. And so several of the descendants think that's very important, and so they've been involved. And so we talk about the DeWolfs in some ways. We screen the film Traces of the Trade, which is about descendants tracing that history and dealing with it. Mm-hmm. But we've also, as an organization have evolved, as we've learned more about this history, we recognize that even though the DeWolfs were a single family in a national story, and so we sometimes kind of like to take the DeWolfs and make them seem like they're the big bad wolves of history, and yet we realize that the entire state of Rhode Island was complicit in the international slave trade, that, you know, basically all Americans were somehow involved.
Yeah. And I imagine, you know, you're a descendant and you learn that, you know, your family, and I guess we're talking about James DeWolf here, who was the Speaker of the Rhode Island House. He was a U.S. Senator, banker, merchant, privateer, owner of numerous rum distilleries. And the family alone, 12,000 Africans and profits from the slave trade. He was, I guess at the time of his death, he was 1837, he was the second richest man in the United States. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for the DeWolfs, when you learn this history, and there are other families like the DeWolfs who learn this history of their families, shocking, I imagine.
Oh, definitely. Definitely shocking. James DeWolf VI, who's one of our board members, we have often thought about how interesting it is that it's possible that his ancestor, whether it was the first James DeWolf or one of the other DeWolfs involved in the slave trade, may have actually been responsible for importing my African ancestors to this country.
Yeah. So are you attempting to involve the descendants of slaves owned by the DeWolf family? And if so, have they been receptive?
We have not been able to connect with anyone just yet. Primarily, that's because we're looking at some of the local stories here and tracing backwards. So finding records of enslaved people who lived here in Providence or lived in different parts of Rhode Island and tracing them back through history. The DeWolf descendants on the African-descended side may know. The DeWolf descendants on the white side definitely know about our organization, and we definitely welcome contact with them and any kind of help or interest.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this film, Traces of the Trade, A Story from the Deep North, which is based on the DeWolf family. That's going to be showing at Falmouth Public Library on Thursday, January 26th, and we're going to have more details about that at the end of the show. But how have members of the Episcopal community in Rhode Island and elsewhere responded to the film and then to the center?
Well, I think in a variety of ways, just because people within the Episcopal Church are so different. We've had a very warm response, especially in the last year as our organization has gotten up and running. But as always, there are a few people who are concerned that maybe we're digging up a past that is best left in the past. Mm. Thankfully, that's a serious minority within the church. And so this past fall, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island passed a resolution, or the churches across the state passed a resolution supporting the creation of the Center for Reconciliation and agreeing to find ways to work along with us, to be welcoming of us into their churches to lead programs, or basically letting us know what it is that they need. Because we recognize, you know, I live in Providence. It's majority-minority. And so the issues that we have here in Providence churches are much different than the churches that are in, you know, South Kingstown, where there's less racial diversity.
Yeah.
So it's important for us to be getting that feedback. And with the resolution, now there's more encouragement that they are actually excited about giving us more feedback and figuring out who we are and bringing us in.
Yeah. And so when they're watching the film, what's the reaction after they see the film? Are they surprised? Do think people are going to go, wow, I didn't know that.
Well, it's surprising information for probably at least 90% of the participants. Surprise is definitely the top reaction. Some people cry. Some people become very emotional and quiet. Others, they get a little upset and they're trying to figure out, well, why didn't I know this information? Why didn't I learn about this in school? Why didn't my family tell me anything about this? You know, a lot of people are just, they're sort of mystified about why they didn't know.
Well, that kind of goes back to that where you're saying some people think the past should be left in the past. When it's something that's difficult to face, sometimes that's the way people react. It's like they don't talk about it. Right. And that's part of your mission, to get people to talk about,
exactly.
about this. So you also have other partners in the center, the Tracing Center and the Center for Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University. So tell us a little bit about the partnership with each of them, starting with the Tracing Center.
Well, the Tracing Center, that's mainly our connection, or one of our primary connections with James DeWolf Perry. He's the James DeWolf VI. And so he was the executive director of that organization, has been doing a lot of amazing work with them. And so he brought the screening program of Traces of the Trade to the Center for Reconciliation. And so that was one of the first programs that we began leading. And then he's been a really great advisor, in our coordinating committee and providing us more information and connections and as our organization has gotten started.
And then Brown University?
And Brown University. So I actually moved to Rhode Island to take the Fellowship for the Study of Slavery and Justice. and at the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice, which had just started right when I arrived. And so the partnership began when Anthony Bogues, who is the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown, joined the board at the Center for Reconciliation, which sometimes I get a little muddled because I work for multiple centers or I've worked for multiple centers. But so he served as a wonderful advisor to our organization as well, keeping us connected to the scholarly community, making sure that we're involved. And there was an amazing conference in the beginning of December that was a partnership between the Slavery and Justice Center, Yale University, and the new National Museum of African American History and Culture, the new Smithsonian. And so he was responsible for making sure that we were involved and had an opportunity to speak to this really amazing group of scholars and museum professionals from across the country at that conference. Yep. So really, really great connection.
Yeah, I would say. And now Brown University also has links to slavery. What are they and how has the university begun to address them?
So with the when Ruth Simmons, who was the first African-American president of Brown University, and I believe one of the first African-American presidents of any Ivy League school, when she was brought in, there was a lot of pressure on her by the community, by students, and it also appears from some of her own personal pressure to address Brown University's racial history. And that seems to have been when it was finally recognized that Brown University, some of the founding board members, founding presidents, founding donors, and organizers were involved either as slave owners or slave traders. Even the name of the university comes from the Brown family. One of our other partners is the John Brown House here in Providence. So we've spent a lot of time working with Brown University and with the John Brown House through the Rhode Island Historical Society. And so because John Brown was a slave trader here, along with his three other brothers, then his money basically, or their money basically, trickled down into descendants who donated to the university, along with the fact that the Browns were there and lobbied for the movement of the, I'm trying to remember what the original name was, the College of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, moving that from its original location to its current home in College Hill in Providence. So they were responsible for that movement. They were board members, they were donors, everything. So it's pretty difficult to look back at Brown University's history and pull out anyone who was not involved in the slave trade and have really anyone left.
Yeah. And again, I think that would shock a lot of people, but how great it is that you've got these connections with these, with like Brown University and these other folks who have these, you know, are descendants from people who were so involved in the slave trade, being willing to come out and, again, educate people and talk about it and try to get conversations going.
Right. And I think it's sort of funny, just for me personally, and maybe it's because I'm a descendant of enslaved people, well, and slave owners. I think it's just necessary.
Sure.
This is real history, and we should be focusing less on the shame that makes us want to quiet and silence this history, and focusing more on how, on the enormous impact this history had on shaping our nation. The Browns, the DeWolfs, and all the other slave trading individuals and families, the Hopkins, Stephen Hopkins, signer of the Declaration of Independence, owned enslaved people. His younger brother, Isaac Hopkins, was the captain of a horribly doomed slave ship called the Sally. These are people who were hugely important in our nation's history and our local Providence and Rhode Island history. And it's not very well taught in local schools. Most residents of the state don't know this information. I had absolutely no idea about any of this information before I moved here, and I had already started studying the history of slavery when I was an undergrad.
Hmm. During the 17 and 1800s, many states in New England were part of the shipping industry, everyone from boat builders and sailmakers to captains, crew, and owners. Do we know how much of the economy of New England during that time had links to the slave trade?
We do. There's been several scholars who have tracked down how much money, how much of the economy was really involved in it. And it's really the majority of the economy was somehow involved in not just the shipping of the building of the ships that eventually carried enslaved people, but also investing in the ships. We had people who would invest in slave ships like lotteries. So if a ship came back and had a good, you know, good product, you know, that had sold all of its imprisoned Africans, then anyone who invested in it, even if they only invested a few pounds, would get, you know, to double that money or something. They would increase that money. So there were, you know, practically infinite amount of ways that people were involved. So it wasn't just the shipping industry. It was the rum industry. It was the barrel making industry. So that's also logging. It's basically everything somehow somehow touches slavery.
We're talking with Elan Cook. She's the program manager at the Center for Reconciliation, and we're talking about New England's hidden slave history. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elan Cook. She's the program manager at the Center for Reconciliation, and we're talking about New England's hidden slave history, particularly in Rhode Island. What does reconciliation mean to you, and are you finding it means different things to different people?
It definitely has different meanings to different people, and it's a term that I've personally wrestled with a bit. My understanding of its definition is really bringing together something that has been broken. And within the Episcopal Church, from the Book of Common Prayer, there's this really amazing passage about how the mission of the church is to restore all people to unity with God and with each other in Christ. And so that's really why the church chose the term reconciliation, and that's why it really works. The idea is to bring people who have been split apart for one reason or another back together. Mm-hmm. And our work really here is to do racial reconciliation, to focus on bringing people who have been split apart, who stand on different sides of a human-created racial dividing line, and bring people back together, reconcile them to one another.
And there are folks who have a different view on that, right?
Yes. There's first, I personally kind of wish that there was a way we could say that it's more about reconciling people to one another. The farther back in history we go, the farther we, you know, the fact that people are starting off in different places. And so you could say that you were maybe, and I feel like it's probably, you know, maybe thinking about it more deeply than necessary, but, you know, we could say that we're reconciling blood, of bringing people back to the very origins of humanity, where we were all one very original people before people split onto different continents. But there are some people who say, well, we've always been separated, so we would be conciling ourselves versus reconciling, coming back together. We'd be coming together for the first time. And I think in our nation's history, we probably are actually coming together for the first time.
When people question why we should bear responsibility for the actions or beliefs of our forefathers, how do you respond to them?
Well, I think that because we have to, part of it is that African Americans in this country, American Indians, Asian Americans, Latinos, we've never been allowed to distance ourselves from our racial history. We've always been connected. We've always been forced to be connected to those who came before us. It's more white Americans who feel like they've never had to be connected to those before them. They were individuals. White Americans are allowed to be individuals, where I must be a black American who's a descendant of slavery. So I think it's more about us all carrying this burden of history together versus people of color being forced to carry it alone.
That's a great way to put it. bearing it all together. I like that. And part of the mission of the center is to train individuals to become reconcilers. So what does that mean, and what kind of skills and knowledge does one need to become a reconciler?
Well, the first part really is to have a better understanding of your history and your place in it. So what is it about your different components of your identity to help build up who you are, and how the different components of identity affect how other people see you? So understanding yourself is part of it. Also understanding what you know versus what you don't know about our nation's history, becoming educated, filling in the gaps. And so that's why we spend so much time bringing in historians, lecturers, scholars, doing historical presentations and educating the public. The second part is getting the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. We find that a lot of people are afraid to have conversations about race because they don't know what words to use.
Right.
Can I say black? Can I say African American? I mean, the fact that I've had so many people stumble over just using the term black, and you see their faces contorting as they're trying to figure out, can I say black to a black person? Is that offensive? Can I say Negro? Can I use the N-word? Is that okay? Educating people about what is the vocabulary, what are the correct terms to be using right now, and also the history of these different terms, how we evolved from, from different ethnic groups in Africa to being Negroes as a universal, to being slaves as a universal, to being African American, to being Afro American, to being black. What's that progression? How did Irish people suddenly become white? These are all things that are really important vocabulary understandings, the history of these words. Mm. And so once you have the history, once you have the terms, then actually having opportunities to practice having conversations about race in a safe space. And so that's a lot of what we do, is setting up opportunities for people to learn something new, get a couple new words, and then practice.
Right.
And then bounce ideas off of each other. Can I use this term? Can I talk about this topic as a white person? Is that okay? Or can only black people talk about this topic? So it's a lot of letting people practice, letting people role play. If they've received a question from a child, or if they've received a really upsetting comment from a friend or a colleague, then bringing that to a group of people and then having a conversation about what's a different way you could have responded to that upsetting thing that you went through that had something to do with race.
Yeah, 2016 was a year of deepening racial divides. Given the current political and social dialogue around race, how do we move forward to start conversations about race and get everyone to the table?
I really believe that it's about educating yourself, really being critical of who you are as an individual and how you see the world and how you see others, and starting the conversation. It's one of those, I heard one of those commercials about, physical fitness and going to the gym, and about how the hardest thing about going to the gym is actually going to the gym. The hardest thing about having a conversation about race sometimes is just having the conversation. There's that fear that stops you from even talking about it, from even identifying someone as being a racialized other who's different from you. That just puts a barrier up for so many people. And sometimes it's just starting talking.
Yeah. So what do you think then is missing in our conversations about race in this country? The conversation that itself in some instances, right?
Honestly, I think it's love. Which, I mean, maybe it sounds a little funny, but I think sometimes we're so wrapped up in our anger or so wrapped up in frustration, we forget how to love people across difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean, romantic love. I'm not saying go out and date people from other races if that's how we're going to fix everything. I mean have real, genuine, agape love The kind that is challenging, the kind that says, even though the things that you say to me are upsetting or you make me so angry, I love you so much that I'm going to be here to help push you toward becoming a better person. And also loving ourselves enough to demand that people treat us better. And so I think a lot of people of color, we've been demanding and demanding and demanding for better treatment in this country. And we're asking that white people love us enough to treat us as well as we deserve to be treated, to treat us better.
It's funny, I was thinking of this morning, not only treat better, but be able to speak up in defense.
Yes.
That's huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean something beyond safety pins. I mean actually going into action for people of color. And there have been so many amazing models out there. Here at the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island, we have a nonprofit that was created to honor the legacy of Jonathan Daniels, who was an Episcopalian. I believe he was a seminary student back in the 60s, who went south during the Civil Rights Movement and died protecting a black girl who was being physically assaulted. Yeah. And I'm not saying you necessarily have to put your life on the line, but that you would think better about the world, that you would educate yourself, that you would, when you see something horrible going on in front of you, that you would find a way to stop it. And if you don't feel safe, if you don't feel like you can stop it, then at least being a witness and then testifying to the fact that you saw this thing happening. I think that's so, so incredibly important. There's so many times that we have people in this country who have been bystanders. I myself have been a bystander in times when I did not know how I could improve a bad situation. And it was really about learning what could I do next time, practicing, so that the next time something negative happens, the next time someone says something awful to someone in front of me, that I have words to say, I have actions to do to make that situation better.
Now, while the Center for Reconciliation hasn't yet opened its doors, you are offering walking tours of historic Providence, highlighting the city's connection to the domestic and international slave trade. What are some of the stops on the tour and the history that you discuss?
So the Center for Reconciliation's building is not open, but we are definitely open for business, and we have been for about a year, which has really, really been exciting. So we have six stops on our walking tour of the neighborhood of College Hill in Providence. And we start off at the intersection of Brown Street and Power Street in College Hill, which is right up the street from Brown University. And we talk about the intersection of brown skin with power, of the fact that Brown is for the Brown family and power is for the Power family, these powerful families who had the privilege of living in one of the most expensive parts, or actually the most expensive part of the city, and what kind of privileges you get from living in that neighborhood. And so we really like to talk about these different intersections throughout the tour.
Yeah.
We go to the John Brown House. We talk about the slave ship, the Sally, which they had taken on board 196 imprisoned Africans off the coast of West Africa. And by the end of the voyage, there were only 90 people left. We talk about how that happened, everything that led up to that, how the ship was equipped, the fact that a lot of those people died because there was an insurrection, because Africans were trying to take control back over their lives and get back home, and how they were killed in order to put down the insurrection, in order to continue on to the Caribbean and sell them, in order to make profit for the Brown brothers of Rhode Island. Then we move on to Brown University, where we go to the John Carter Brown Library, and we look at original documents from the slave ship Sally and also from the building of Brown University. we see how some of the buildings on campus were built with a mix of enslaved and free labor, and that's enslaved African and enslaved American Indian. Then we move to University Hall, which was the building that was made of that mixed labor. And we talk about the use of rented labor, rented enslaved people. And we make that connection to how the White House and how the National Capitol building were also created with that mix of enslaved labor. And we learn from Frederick Douglass, who, before his escape from slavery, how he had been rented out as an enslaved laborer doing work, and how he would actually get the money in his hand for a hard day of work or a hard week of work, and then he was forced to transfer that to his owners, and how unfair that was, and how the use of a combination of enslaved and free white labor devalued free labor in this country and kept the wages low, which then pitted white laborers against blacks, and how that kept the constant reinforcement of negative racial stereotypes and the pitting people against each other who, because of their life circumstances, may be living very similar lifestyles, but unfortunately are being pitted against each other across race for some of the first times in our nation's history. We go to Stephen Hopkins' house. We talk about how he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence while also owning enslaved people. We talk about different abolitionists in the area and how we had one of the Brown brothers who, after the slave ship Sally, tried to get out of the slave trade. He got out of the slave trade. He sold the or freed the enslaved people that he owned, but then he got into the textile business in a textile factory that was producing cotton textiles, and his cotton was coming from plantations that were being worked by enslaved people. So he thought he was getting out of slavery, but he was still in slavery. And then we end our tour in the Cathedral of St. John's Cemetery, where we talk about three formerly enslaved women who were buried in a cemetery out back, and then how the Cathedral of St. John had a racially integrated church, but people were segregated physically from each other. There was a slave gallery during slavery, and then afterward, people were still somehow segregated from each other. And then we talk about the creation of our organization and what our mission is and what we're meant to do for the future of our state.
And what's the timeline for the physical space of the center to open? I mean, you know, the museum part of it.
We're looking at about 2 years right now, and that's mainly because we have a lot of money that we're working on fundraising for restoring the building. The church itself was built in 1810, so it's a historic cathedral. And the cathedral congregation, the final cathedral congregation that left several years ago, was not able to keep up with a lot of the necessary maintenance. And then once that congregation left, the church sat basically empty for a lot of time. And so because of the historic building, and, you know, if you don't live in a house, the house falls apart. If you don't use the church falls apart. It needs to be loved. It needs to be used. And so we're right now trying to bring that love and that use back to the church and restore it.
Right. Alon Cook is the program director at the Center for Reconciliation at the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island in Providence. She's going to be the keynote speaker at the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. National Holiday Breakfast hosted by No Place for Hate in Falmouth Monday, January 16th at 9:30. Also at 7 p.m. on Thursday, January 26th, the public is invited to that free community screening of the film Traces of the Trade, A Story from the Deep North. We'll have details about both of the events as well as a link to the center at our website, capeandislands.org. Alon Cook, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much.